This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, March 22nd, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we move through the alphabet with stories from A to, well, G. We're celebrating the 23rd anniversary of the show by going in sequence.
First, a bill that would have directed a portion of state revenue from certain sales taxes to the Highway and Transportation Department failed to pass a House committee yesterday, though its sponsor says it could get another try in committee. Representative Jonathan Barnett, a Republican from Siloam Springs, sponsored the bill and says if he does bring it back up, it will have to compete with other bills cutting or reallocating state funding.
There's a lot of bills out there that impact the future revenue of this state, and I know a lot of people are concerned about, you know, the mix of those bills, and maybe depending on what happens with some of those bills, we'll see what happens to this bill.
Meanwhile, as state lawmakers consider incentives for a company to build a billion-dollar steel mill in East Arkansas, a potential competitor is ratcheting up its objections. Roby Brock with Talk Business Arkansas has details.
Nucor's latest objections seem to be centered around the fact that they have concerns about the potential capacity for the type of steel that Big River Steel would be making. They feel like that those competitive pressures could reduce their productivity and profitability, which could lead to lower tax revenues in the state of Arkansas. And they've also almost made a threat that if this Big River Steel project moves forward, that they'll consider moving some of their employees to other states where there is less competition in order to ramp up operations there. I think this is going to be a big pressure point on legislators to weigh when they make their decision on this big super project.
Big River Steel wants the state to approve issuing $125 million in bonds to help the plant's construction.
Growing opposition to a large hog breeding operation newly permitted on Big Creek, a tributary of the Buffalo National River, organized as the Buffalo National River Alliance, says it has collected more than 6,000 petition signatures to block industrial farming on the Buffalo. And the protest is rousing interest in a state legislator, Warwick Sabin, a Democratic state representative from Little Rock.
I'm certainly going to work as hard as I can here in the state legislature to make sure that we protect the Buffalo National River, that we protect the Big Creek tributary, and that we protect all of our natural resources in Arkansas, because it's our job to protect them for future generations. And we have to make these decisions with that long-term vision in mind and not just short-term vision and the interests of a very small group of people.
The swine operation, C&H Hog Farms near Mount Judy in Newton County, is the first large confined feeding animal operation in Arkansas under new state agricultural regulations. The farm is permitted to house 6,500 hogs and pigs, producing several millions of gallons of liquid waste annually. The effluent will be spread on nearby farm fields as fertilizer. Opponents worry the waste will leach into Big Creek, which feeds into the Buffalo River. Members of the group are appearing before the regular meeting of the Arkansas Commission of Pollution Control and Ecology today in Little Rock.
Two bills to tighten regulations on body art procedures in the state are on their way to the House for a vote after passing the House Public Health and Welfare Committee yesterday. The bills, sponsored in the House by Representative Deborah Ferguson, a Democrat from West Memphis, set an age limit for body art and prohibit subdermal implants. Ferguson says she's not trying to limit free expression.
The goal is not to limit people's liberties or for them to have tattoos or piercings or anything they would like to have, but to bring some safety to the industry.
Both bills are now receiving support from members of the tattoo industry.
Crystal Ridge's Museum of American Art is adding new works to the collection. The museum announced yesterday it's acquired Andy Warhol's Hammer and Sickle and Donald Judd's Untitled 1989. The Warhol is a 6x7-foot work created by the iconic artist in 1977, and the Donald Judd work features 10 copper and red plexiglass box-like elements. Three other works, Max Weber's Burlesque No. 1 from 1909, Agnes Pelton's 1932 painting titled Sandstorm, and Marvin Dewart Cohn's 1936 oil on canvas Stone City, are also now part of the collection. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
We're celebrating an anniversary today.
Your anniversary, actually.
My anniversary. This month marks 23 years that I've been producing Ozarks at Large.
Wow.
The 10th was the actual day.
Sure.
But what we've done with this is usually toward the end of the month somewhere. A couple years ago, we did Our Favorite Sounds.
Uh-huh.
Yesterday, which was the last year, which was the 22nd anniversary, Tutu.
Pairs.
We did Pairs. So we thought, what if we did stuff in sequence, because it's the 23rd
uh-huh.
anniversary. And you would think we'd do numbers. But
no.
We're doing letters.
We're doing letters.
As in A, B, C, etc.
Yep.
And we start with A.
We do. We start with the Arkansas Country Doctor Museum, something I've heard you mention a couple of times, and I kind of wanted to make my way out there and finally did. So, the Arkansas Country Doctor Museum was founded in 1994, and it was the second such museum established in the United States. Located in Lincoln, the museum was established to honor the achievements and service of Arkansas Country doctors, including the three doctors who lived and worked on the museum premises from 1936 to 1973. The clinic and private home used by these doctors now house the museum's collection of medical instruments and medicines, an 1886 doctor's buggy, and an herb garden, among other things. Tomorrow morning, the museum will celebrate a new expansion to its campus.
And this is actually the start of it. Now this part is the living area, and all three doctors actually lived here and practiced here. And they were Dr. John Lacey Bean, Dr. Carl Bergenstahl, and then Dr. Herbert Boyer.
Office manager Diana Hale has been with the museum since 2008, and one of her responsibilities includes giving tours to guests. After leading a small group through the various rooms of the museum, she enters the newest part of the campus, which is called the Memorial Room. She says they are very proud to have this area because they'll be able to display more items from the museum's collection. Diana says several donations, as well as bequests from the Hall and Boyer families, allowed them to build this new room onto the existing museum.
We feel like Dr. Joe would have liked this, but just being able to move things around and to get it more original, the way he remembered it several years ago. Like I said, Dr. Hall, this was his baby. He loved this museum with all his heart. We loved him with all ours, and we sure miss him. He very special man. And then the Boyers, as long as they were here, many people in Lincoln remember the Boyers, you know, still yet, and the old time coming into the clinic to get their shots or so ever. And we have some that come in, they're older now, but they remember Dr. Boyer stitching them up or, you know, different things like that. So hopefully the board made, I feel, a very good decision to add this on in honor of both of the Boyer family and the Hall family.
The south wall of the Memorial Room features items that are connected to Dr. Joe B. Hall, including a photograph, a portrait, and a framed email he sent to friends when he was diagnosed with terminal colon cancer.
And it said, "Please spread the word. Joe Hall, the old doctor, is going on a long trip. I have been planning this trip for a long time, soon to be 85 years. I still don't know my date of departure. However, I think it's playfully remains one of the surprises of the venture. I expect the trip to happen a few weeks to a few months from now. You, my email buddies, have been a major fun-filled source of wisdom, beauty, peace, and joy for many years. Please continue to write me. I love it and I need it. I am planning and building a beautiful death which will get rid of the worn-out old body. Pain, dysfunction, fatigue, and disease will no longer be present. Death is the final healing of all disease. No longer will I be confined by time or space. Instant travel will be available 24/7. Although I cannot get my mind around this, I am told I will be able to be in all places at all times, sharing perfect love with everyone and everything."
The Memorial Room also features a case full of different bottles of medicine, an old wheelchair, and an iron lung.
See that? That's like your diaphragm working. Your air in, your air out. Your air in.
An iron lung is a metal cylinder that helped victims of polio breathe if the disease left them paralyzed. One such patient who was paralyzed from the neck down was Peggy McCormick. Peggy contracted polio at the age of 16, and she lived in an iron lung for 31 years. Office manager Diana Hale explains that despite the complications caused by polio, Peggy was able to become an artist.
Miss Peggy decided when she was in the hospital that she wanted to do something with her life. So she decided she wanted to learn how to paint. So the nurses got you remember the velvet paintings where you paint by number? They got her some of those and they taped the stick to the paintbrush. She held that stick in her teeth and moved it with her tongue. They call them a mouth artist, but to me, she used her tongue. I mean, that's how she actually painted. The paintings that you see up there were done by Peggy McCormick. She sold them at crafts fairs to help with her bills and to help her family. She was born in Elkins, and they moved to Fayetteville after this happened to her so she could be closer to care.
Peggy's portraits and paintings of birds hang on the west wall of the memorial room. Another one of her items included in the exhibit is her book of poetry titled My Spirit is Free, Reflections from an Iron Lung.
From this small bed on which I lie, I only see one patch of sky, but ever changing, ever new, within the limits of my view. How often through the hours I look to read a page in my sky book. When I awake at break of day, I check the weather, blue or gray. I watch the clouds of angel hair.
Diana says it's important for a museum to exist where items like Peggy's poetry book and old medical instruments can be displayed because it provides a way to educate the public.
I think it's important for children to see, you know, what their grandparents may have, you know, when they tell their grandkids stories about, you know, Doc Smith, or, you know, they can actually see some of the stuff. Or like the polio, you know, it's eradicated here in the United States now, but they need to know, you know, why they have those vaccinations. I know some, you know, really don't like to get their kids vaccinated anymore, but that right there, when you see a machine and hear it run and think about hearing that for 31 years, it would make me think again, you know. I think it's very important to help educate kids and even parents.
The dedication of the museum's new expansion will take place tomorrow morning at 10, and the public is invited to attend. The Arkansas Country Doctor Museum is open from 1 to 4 p.m. Wednesday through Saturday. More information is available at drmuseum.net.
That's the song El Camino by James Super Chicken Johnson. He's from Clarksdale, Mississippi, and will be one of the headliners for this year's Blues in the Natural State Festival in downtown Fayetteville, Friday and Saturday, April 5th and 6th. Super Chicken is scheduled to go on stage at George's Majestic Lounge on the Friday night of the festival, beginning at 10:30. B for this anniversary show is for blues. And we caught up with the man in charge of this year's Blues in the Natural State Festival, Roger Plour. And we asked him about the event and specifically about Super Chicken.
I got an opportunity to see him at the Eureka Springs Blues Weekend a couple of years ago. And he really knows how to engage the crowd. And people that night at the Basin Park Hotel were just loving his performance. He's a very, you know, interesting guy, you know, as well. He's a self-taught musician, and he's got kind of a style that is cool and gritty with deep roots and sort of traditional country blues. He is also a guitar builder. I don't know if you know that, but he tends to build his guitars from recycled parts.
One of the great things about this blues festival Blues in the Natural State Festival is that it's multi-venue. On Friday night alone, you're at three different places on Dixon Street in Fayetteville.
Yeah, and actually, it's three different places, but there's actually four music
stages. Yeah,
four stages. So, so that's very exciting. The other thing that we've done this year is we tried this concept last year when the festival was one day, and we had four music rooms, and we sold tickets on the basis of, you know, a wristband that would get you into any of the venues, and that seemed to work really well for us. So what we were very happy this year that we were able to expand the festival to 2 days. And on Saturday, well, on Friday, we'll be using the four music stages. But on Saturday, we're going to be actually using six stages. And between the Friday and Saturday this year, we have 24 acts booked at these six music venues. So we were, and I have to say that we were only able to do that with some strong support of some sponsors this year. Primarily, Walmart came in and helped us out tremendously and very generously with being able to produce this festival, as did the City of Fayetteville, the Advertising and Promotion Commission.
I love the lineup because it is a great mix. We mentioned Super Chicken, who's from Clarksville, Mississippi, but there's a great mix of local, regional, and then the national. I mean, people who go to live music around here will recognize a lot of the names. Leah and the Mojo Doctors, R.J. Michaud, Sarah Hughes, Earl and Them. You really put together a lineup that is familiar and adventurous at the same time.
Well, thank you. That was the goal because one of the things that we wanted to do is we don't want to have the same people play, you know, the festival year after year, and we'd like to introduce artists that people coming to the festival, whether they're local or if they're coming from Fort Smith or Little Rock, perhaps might not have heard of this particular artist or act, but once they get here, I have to say that I think at any one of the venues that festival goers choose to go and listen to music, I think they're going to be treated to a real quality performance. And I think that goes back to, you know, going back a little bit, one of the problems with the blues genre is that you know, unless you're a B.B. King or a Keb Moe or Bonnie Raitt, most of these artists are not household names. So, you know, you have to be really, you know, interested and a real blues fan to even know who a lot of these artists are.
You know, that's what's great about a festival. Is you may be drawn in because you know one or two of the acts, but I think it's even more exciting for a music fan to you know, kind of go in not knowing who Ernest Guitar Roy is, say, and then be blown away. I want to talk about you.
Ernest was at our festival last year, and just as you said, most people had no idea who he was. But he did such a tremendous job had for us last year. The performance was, you know, was outstanding. You know, people were, you know, talking about it for, you know, several months after the fact, and that's why we had him. Ask them to come back, you know, this year.
And occasionally something can happen that's almost transformative. I remember I didn't know who Roy Rogers was several years ago at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. I'm walking out for the day, and the blues tent's still going, and it's Roy Rogers. And he has the entire crowd with him. And, I mean, it doesn't happen that often, but when something like that can happen, it's magical.
Absolutely, and I think that we're going to and hopefully see that with Super Chicken's performance, because that's what he has the ability to do. He really, as I mentioned before, really has the ability to, you know, he really engages the audience, and they feel that they're part of the whole performance, you know, whether they're dancing like chickens or, hooting and hollering and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, one other new thing that we're trying this year is on Saturday afternoon, we're trying to do a, we're calling it the Afternoon Blues, and it's going to be a performance, more of a listening type performance at the Walton Arts Center's Star Theater. And headlining that afternoon is Ray Bonneville, who's from Austin, Texas. And he was the 2012 International Blues Challenge winner in the solo duo category. And I don't know if you know about Ray, but he's Canadian-born, U.S. raised. He's sort of a blues-influenced singer, songwriter, guitarist, and harmonica player. He's kind of a one-man band, you know. You know, he's kind of known for his loose, bluesy, swampy kind of vibe, and he plays a special kind of blend of blues and Americana music, where every song does tell a very specific story, and it kind of leads the listener oftentimes into figuring out either the story itself or what the message is that he's trying to get across.
Crossing flowers by the side of the road in the hour of long shadows. Fading name, hard to read, lost in among the weeds. I see dice rolling.
Roger, thanks so much for your time, and you and your colleagues all there at the Society, thanks for putting this together.
Hey, thank you for having me on the show again, Kyle.
Roger Plouard is with the Ozark Blues Society, and he talked to me about the 11th annual Blues in the Natural State Festival taking place in downtown Fayetteville Friday, April 5th and Saturday, April 6th. Also playing will be two-time Grammy nominee John Lee Hooker Jr. He'll close the festival on Saturday night. You can find out more about the festival at the website ozarkbluessociety.org and follow the links. Later in the program, by the way, we'll have a question about the festival that could help you win a weekend pass to the Blues in the Natural State Festival, April 5th and 6th.
This is a special anniversary edition of Ozarks at Large, 23 years of the program as a news magazine format. And we're doing stories in alphabetical order, so from B for Blues to C for Chill Out. Ozarks at Large's Meredith Martin-Motes has been in need, she says, of doing just that.
Everywhere you look, you're probably reminded of the need to eat better, exercise more, and seek out ways to reduce stress and tension in your life. Here's a confession. Sometimes just hearing the word healthy stresses me out. I'm pretty sure that that's not, you know, healthy. And here's something else that stresses me out. People telling me I need to decrease my stress level. That really stresses me out. In the deepest part of my being, I want nothing more than to be healthy. I want this for myself, but even more so for my 3-year-old twin sons. At their age, all waking hours revolve around nonstop play and this endless quest for bliss and joy. But it won't be long before they're adults with their own complex and busy lives. Things will get intense. They'll forget to take time for the small stuff, maybe start eating cookies for lunch. After all, if they perpetually see their role models put their own health on the back burner, chances are they will too. So if I care so much about health, why does all this talk of improvement make me feel anxious? I think it comes down to this. Far too often, discussions of health and healing sound more like bullet points on a checklist rather than a fundamental shift in the way we approach our daily lives. In other words, just something else to add to that growing list of things that I never seem to accomplish. It makes me feel like I'm going to fail before I even start. Don't get me wrong, I love a good to-do list, and I'd be absolutely lost without mine. Every morning, I get out a piece of paper. At the top, I write, make to-do list. Underneath that, I jot down a series of items like finish column, update blog, schedule vet appointments, take children to the library, do dishes. After my list is complete, I return to the top, and I ever so joyfully cross off that first item. Such fulfillment. But all joking aside, I've been writing put away clean laundry on my to-do list since my kids were born 3 years ago, and I almost never get around to crossing it off. What I'm really looking for is a full-on paradigm shift, a version of health much more nuanced than, say, caloric intake. And I need a new language to help me get there. So the other night, I tried out a yoga class. I've always been curious about yoga's holistic approach to body awareness and acceptance of life in the moment. But honestly, it was the free introductory class that really drew me in. I came home feeling somewhat relaxed and encouraged. I've got to put that on my to-do list for next week, I thought to myself. If you're one of those people who finds motivation in berating yourself with how far you have to go, then more power to you. It's taken me years to figure this out, but for me, that's just a waste of my energy. I've found only one thing capable of fueling my burgeoning commitment to greater health: accepting where I'm at. These hips may make it impossible to fit into the clothes of my youth, but they're the product of growing two babies, and for that reason, I'm kind of proud of them. And yes, my stress level sometimes goes through the roof, but it's typically the result of time spent doing one of the hardest jobs known to humankind, parenting. After all, if I wasn't stressed out at least part of the time, I wouldn't be paying attention. Acknowledging these things doesn't mean I want to remain perpetually out of shape with a frazzled, stressed-out brain. In fact, it's just the opposite. Pondering obligations of meeting some kind of health checklist tend to make me feel deflated, even angry. Learning to be okay with where I'm at actually gives me energy. After all, health isn't some kind of stack of folded laundry waiting to be put away. It's a gradual process that requires not just effort, but love, patience, perseverance, and any of those other large order concepts that can't be restricted to a to-do list. When I got home from my first yoga class, my sons met me at the door. "You went to your yo-yo class?" they asked me, faces filled with curiosity. I thought about correcting them, but I decided that yo-yo class is a much better phrase for my state of health these days. Since that day, I've made some slow but steady progress. Coming to grips with the current version of myself has been unexpectedly energizing. Sometimes I don't even mind trading ice cream for veggies. More often than not, I actually look forward to my morning workouts, and sometimes, I find the strength to take long, deep breaths when I get angry, rather than mimic the toddler tantrum behavior I'm supposed to be discouraging. And that all seems pretty healthy. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Meredith Martin-Motes.
Meredith Martin-Motes is the editor of The Boiled Down Juice and the director of the McElroy House, Organization for Folklife, Oral History, and Community Action, and she's a regular contributor to Ozarks at Large.
A week from tonight, the 112 Drive-In opens for another warm weather season of entertainment. As we continue our sequential trip on this anniversary edition of Ozarks at Large, Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas says D is for drive-in.
There's something about a drive-in movie. Warm summer nights with the windows down, a speaker hooked to the edge. Or perhaps you always arrive early, backing your truck up to face the screen, blankets in the bed to make a pallet. Then there's the image of children playing on the playground below the screen. Or perhaps high school lovebirds snuggled in the back seat of their parents' car. The 112 Drive-In Theater is just one of fewer than 400 in the United States. Jimmy Terry has been with this theater for much of its life. And for much of his life, he has worked in the film industry. Jimmy got his start as a 13-year-old boy back in 1947 in an indoor theater. He was drafted into the Army in 1955 and was actually a supervising projectionist at Fort Sill in Oklahoma. When he was released from the Army, The movie industry was a bit different than when Jimmy went in.
While I was in the Army, television started coming to Northwest Arkansas strong, and so indoors were closing, but drive-ins was the real thing. You know, everybody, they were new. All the people and families, and it was a place for people to come. You know, they came to the drive-ins, and drive-ins were big for several years.
Involved heavily in the drive-in since 1958, Jimmy, theater manager at the 112 Drive-In on 112 in Fayetteville, says that daylight savings time and rising gas prices led to the disappearance of drive-ins. The 71 Drive-In on 71 was where Fiesta Square now sits. That theater opened in August of 1950, remaining there until 1980. Ambient light is important to show a movie outdoors. With Fayetteville's expansion encroaching on the theater, it moved to its current location. Ellen Bowling is the manager at 112. She's worked at the theater since 1986. For her, the drive-in is nostalgic and equates to family. She thinks that feeling is what keeps people coming.
I believe that people still really enjoy coming to the drive-in. I believe that they like the freedom that they have. You know, they can bring their kids and themselves, and they don't have to be quiet as they do. So it's good for young couples with babies and stuff like that. And the trend-wise, I think that people, you know, they like the walk-ins, of course, but I think that they just really, the nostalgia alone, my generation, they always say they want their kids to experience the drive-in, you know, because it was a big part of my life when I was growing up. And I hear a lot of people say that you haven't been to a movie till you go to a drive-in. Just a different atmosphere altogether.
The concession stand plays to that nostalgia, with vintage light fixtures, wallpaper, and pictures. Even the setup seems vintage. A door for customers leads them directly into the line, guided by wrought iron fencing. And while many theaters now have digital signage, here they use the kind with the whiteboard and blue letters, arranged by hand.
We have, actually, it's like a restaurant. We have nachos and cheese and french fries, hot dogs, burritos, funnel cakes, the popcorn, the drinks, and all kinds of candy and hamburgers. And
however, some things have to change. This year, viewers will see a digital projection on the metal screen at the end of the gravel field. The film companies just aren't going to make film anymore, which means 112 has to install a new digital projector. This one will take a small USB rather than large reels of film.
And it's a lot better. You'll see a brighter screen here at the 112, and no film scratches or anything, and you'll have a brighter, clearer picture. So,
on the day I visit, the new digital projector sits in a large cardboard box on the floor of the concession area, waiting to be carried upstairs to the projection room. Jimmy says professionals will be coming soon to swap the old with the new. He says this old one will be junk. But I think that with shows like American Pickers and Pawn Stars, what is old is often found to be new by someone else. The old projector is much larger than I envisioned. It sits close to a large window and aims out toward the white metal screen. Next to it is some sort of contraption to aid with the loading of the film. A pole connects the floor to the ceiling, holding up three circular plates about a foot apart and perhaps 4 or 5 feet in diameter. Jimmy explains how it works, though Ellen is usually the one making sure the movies play without interruption.
Did you ever notice the little cue marks in the upper right-hand corner or even on television? The first one is you start your machine and open your dowser, and the second one, you had a changeover foot pedal to change it, and it changed it. Nobody knew the difference, but you had to know what you were doing. But anyhow,
the walls of this projection room are lined with speakers, the kind that are attached to poles out in the theater. Though they are still working, they aren't really needed, And yet another aspect of the drive-in theater will be phased out. If you tune in to 92.7 FM, that's what you'll hear right now. But come next Friday around 8 p.m., your car speakers will be transformed into surround sound.
Over here. This unit here is a sky monitor system, and everything is run through it and through all the other stuff, amplifiers and processors and so on, and then it broadcasts it out to the cars. Mm-hmm. There's the antenna that's on the inside.
Today, many cars come with high-quality speakers, ones that could rival any home sound system. As cars have gotten fancier, they too have grown. Many families now drive tall, large Suburbans, Tahoes, Escalades. Yet another aspect of the times that the drive-in theater has had to adjust to. Here's Ellen Bowling.
They can't park just anywhere they want to because the small cars has to park in the front, and then we have the last five rows and over by the ladies' restrooms, a graveled area designated strictly for the bigger vehicles. And so, you know, that kind of is the biggest problem we have, is getting people to understand we're not really forcing them to do something. We're just trying to get them to park in the best place they can see.
Depending on the size of the cars, the 112 drive-in can hold about 520 vehicles. Average is about four people per car. That's over 2,000 people gathered to watch a first-run film. Theater managers are thrilled to say that last year they ran all first-run, meaning they had movies the same day they were released in indoor theaters. To find out what will be playing when the theater opens next week, look for the announcement on the vintage 112 theater sign out front, or visit numbers 112driveintheater.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
It is Friday, March 22nd, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
All right, let's see. We had D for drive-in.
Mm-hmm.
So now E for?
Entertainment.
And who helps us with entertainment better than anybody on the planet?
Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hello.
That was a nice introduction.
Thanks.
So I have a question for you.
Okay.
A trivia, it's a quiz. What has been described as an abomination of desolation that breaks women's backs and causes men to break the Ten Commandments?
Oof. I better not answer what I think that is.
See, I thought you were going to guess March Madness.
Oh, well, yeah, filling out your back brackets, I suppose.
Yeah, but it's really spring cleaning. An event that used to turn a home upside down for at least a week, which might have been the early version of March Madness.
Exactly.
There's an exhibit opening tomorrow in the 1895 Hawkins House at the Rogers Historical Museum titled Spring Cleaning. And it will remind visitors what it was like when women dragged all the rugs outside and beat them, hung all the quilts and bedding on the clothesline to air, and then they started in the attic and they washed walls and they washed windows and they washed baseboards until the last stop, which was the front hall and the kitchen.
Mm.
Terry Lynn Wendling, who is curator of collections at the museum, says women even took the parlor stove apart and put it away.
Well, you didn't. It was going to be hot, right?
And it wasn't going to turn into an air conditioner.
Right, exactly.
So, and then they dusted and they waxed and they did the tables with boiled linseed oil. They took the furniture outside and brushed it or beat it or whatever. Dusted the books. Apparently, men frequently took all of their papers, put them in a roll-top desk, and locked it.
Lest it go flying or
yes,
something?
Just to be safe. So the Hawkins House will include cleaning supplies displayed, like bluing that they used for the most stubbornly soiled fabrics. A lace curtain will be fastened to a curtain stretcher. They'll flip up a corner of the dining room rug to show how they would have taken all the rugs out, beaten them, and put a new layer of newspaper underneath. Yeah.
A lot of work.
Yes. I'm exhausted thinking about it and don't believe I'll do it myself. But if you want to go see it, it's on display Saturday through May 4th at the Hawkins House at the Rogers Historical Museum. You can tour the house and hear all about it. And it is, of course, free.
Absolutely.
This is also Devil's Den Rocks weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Fun stuff going on all day today through Sunday.
Still on the Hill going to be there? Is that right?
Yes. That's Saturday night at 7 or 7:30.
Okay.
right. at the amphitheater, assuming it doesn't snow.
Or whatever.
Or whatever. There's a battle reenactment a year late at Pea Ridge.
Well, the battle reenactment by definition means it's reenacting, so it's not a year late.
But it's not the anniversary.
Okay.
But that's all right.
Well, it is an anniversary.
It is an anniversary. It's 151 years.
There you go. There you go.
That works.
Starts today, continues through 1:30 Sunday. It's not actually at the Pea Ridge National Park either.
Oh.
It's north of Pea Ridge on a private farm because you can't do reenactments on
national
parkland. National
parkland, right.
It's $10 for adults or $25 for a 3-day pass, free for children 14 and younger. You can find out how to find it at arkcivilwar.org. They were expecting perhaps as many as 800 reenactors if the weather holds.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Kite Festival's this weekend.
In Eureka.
From 10 to 4 on Saturday at Turpentine Creek.
Going to have wind.
Yeah.
There's going to be wind.
Yeah. I'd love to go there and see all the new kitties.
Mm-hmm.
And they
right.
are accepting donations to the refuge. Admission to the Kite Festival is free, but you do have to pay if you go on in and see the big cats. The Hershey's Easter Egg Hunt is at 3 o'clock Saturday at Orchards Park in Bentonville. There's a bunny hop and coloring and face painting and magicians and jugglers, and the Easter Bunny will be there.
Very good.
What is a bunny hop?
What is a bunny hop?
Well, it was once a dance.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So are they doing
I assume that it's going to be a bunny hop sort of contest.
Okay.
It's $3 donation for individuals, $5 for family, requested but not required. It benefits the Northwest Arkansas Children's Festival. And there's a concert at 7:30 Saturday as part of the Goddess Festival featuring Harmonia and a group called Broad Daylight at the Omni Center in Fayetteville. That's free. Don't forget Found Fayetteville this weekend.
Oh, that's right.
8 o'clock tonight and tomorrow night at Be Unlimited at 612 West Center Street in Fayetteville. It's $10 that goes toward the four-fingered fundraiser for Amber and Jonathan Perrodin. If you missed that story and you don't know the art community, Jonathan had a run-in with a table saw?
Miter saw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, four-fingered fundraiser. Yeah. Good cause and a good show. And then Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Donald W. Reynolds Boys and Girls Club in Fayetteville is Easter at the Club.
I've been to that with my niece.
Egg hunts, a duck grab, pin the tail on the bunny. No, I don't know if the bunny's happy about that. And frisbee golf. Hmm. And it's free for ages 2 to 11.
All right.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Did I get an A on my E?
You did.
A
cool. plus.
Yes. We've made it from A through E, and we have a double dip for F, Feed Fayetteville. Recently, Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis visited a former church building in downtown Fayetteville, where the local nonprofit organization is creating a new center for operations.
This was the scene last Thursday when 60 to 70 volunteers from Sam's Club convened at this site on Locust Street near the downtown Fayetteville Square. The former church is a white bricked two-story building that was constructed in 1945, but it will soon be home to a local foods campus of sorts for the local group Feed Fayetteville. Adrian Schoenfeld is the executive director of the local nonprofit.
There was a need in the community for a centralized place where people could come and have education and resources and just community efforts combined, because we were all kind of out in the community doing our own thing, and then we didn't really have a centralized location. So this is the embodiment of every activity that we did last year, so we can all come together in one place.
Feed Fayetteville, along with its parent organization Feed Communities, is part of several food security programs in the area. Programs such as Canning Hunger, where produce from local gardens and the Fayetteville Farmers Market are preserved for winter use at community meals programs in the city. With the new facility, the group will be able to have that canning operation on site. Another program among the many that will benefit from the new space is one called Care Cropping,
which is a gleaning program that we do at the farmers market. And we were doing it out of the back of a car last summer, and so this building will help us be more sustainable and just keep the food fresh longer and be able to give a better variety of food instead of taking one location 400 pounds of squash like we did last summer. So it'll help us be more sustainable in our actions. We also have cooking classes that we now do at different Head Starts and churches and around town, so we'll be able to do all those here. And then we'll also have an on-site snap garden, which is we're really excited about doing a little urban ag project and growing food with SNAP participants right here on our campus.
Outside, volunteers proceeded to build several beds for the SNAP gardens. Jack Amerson is one of those volunteers. He tells me how these beds for fresh veggies are being built.
We're moving soil into the mulch gardens so that we can create a layer of topsoil here to grow fruits and vegetables with, and the community can come in and weed and feed and water and pick vegetables out.
But because these are just the first steps in renovating the site, the gardens aren't being built in a permanent fashion.
And we're using straw bales and doing raised beds because we don't really have the permanent master landscape plan down yet. So this year we're just showing that people can grow with limited resources and just pop up in a parking lot, basically.
Showing how to grow a garden in new spaces is one thing that Feed Fayetteville staff hope to teach the community. Melissa Terry is the program coordinator for parent organization Feed Communities. She says that both organizations were formed out of the fruits of a community stakeholders meeting 2 years ago. Terry says that Denise and Hershey Garner called the meeting in response to high statistics of childhood hunger in Arkansas.
And so Denise and Hershey convened a group of stakeholders at St. Paul's Episcopal Church, just to see if we could figure out some basic starting points of, like, is community hunger solvable? What is going on? Why are the statistics so high that one out of every four kids in Washington County is listed as food insecure? And so we had intended for about 20 people to be at the stakeholders meeting, and then in the end, there were 60.
But to lower the number of area residents who are food insecure, the group had to approach the problem with efficiency in mind. So organizers mapped out all of the separate community meals and food resources that were in the area, mainly to determine where there was overlap of services or where partnerships could be beneficial.
The food hub is the physical space that represents the mental work that we did last year of aggregating mentally and by conversations, like all the different food groups that we could think of in community kitchens and whatnot. And then as we progressed, we realized, like Adrian was saying, that we needed a physical space where we could just be a library, a resource, a base camp, a community garden.
Not only are the different programs Feed Fayetteville sponsors designed for efficiency in the community food systems, but the facility is being designed with that conservation in mind. One of the projects that volunteers were working on during the warm March afternoon was the construction of several rain barrels. Volunteer Gary Fisher from Charlotte, North Carolina, says that building one of the 50-gallon plastic rain collectors is simple.
It is pretty easy. All you do is take and cut the top off, drill a hole in the bottom to put the spigot, so when you get the water in, you have an overflow valve on top, and that's pretty much it.
But conservation is only one aspect that drives an organization like Feed Fayetteville. The community aspect is not only where the group focuses its aspirations to help ensure food security, but the community also plays a key role in helping the organization accomplish that mission. For example, the organization didn't purchase its new home. Instead, Feed Fayetteville founders Denise and Hershey Garner purchased the property and gave a 20-year lease to Feed Communities to use the space as offices for the two organizations. But Seanfield says that the community helps the organization in other ways as well.
And like Melissa was talking about the garden tool share, we don't even have garden tools ourselves yet, so we are actually borrowing from Tricycle Farm. So we all work together. And I think that just the, by definition, a nonprofit serves the community and the communities we work together. So we definitely rely on community support for everything that we do. And we appreciate all the support that we get, too.
The idea of the community giving back was a visible characteristic during the volunteer day. Many of the volunteers were Sam's Club associates who were otherwise in the area for training at the retailer's home office in Bentonville. Robert Cotter, from the Los Angeles suburb of Riverside, California, says that giving back to community organizations is inherent in the company's corporate culture.
It's kind of a way of life with Sam's Club. It's just kind of way you pick it up when you go on. You see how everybody else is, you know, contributing to the community and stuff, and you just want to be a part of it. It's just part of our culture that we give back and stuff and that. And part of our culture is, you know, we all opted to stay an extra day, and, you know, we could be going home today, but we decided to stay and give back. And this was something that our office set up for us because, you know, we just, like I said, we want to contribute back to our community. Our home office is right here, and we want to give back. So it's all part of it.
The connotation of community, as it relates to sharing, not only applies to sharing resources within a distinct geographical or municipal region, but it also brings with it the notion of sharing those ideas with other populations and other communities. Jack Hickey, an associate from Battle Creek, Michigan, is putting a fresh coat of varnish on a shelf that will be used to store canned produce. He says that he doesn't know if there are similar food security programs in his area.
Oh, but I'm going to go back and find out. I know we have farmers markets, but we're directly involved with the community like this and learning about the percent of children that go without fruit and vegetables here in this particular county and in Fayetteville was surprising and alarming, and now I want to go back in my community and see if I have the same thing.
Melissa Terry says that the community ideas don't even need to be shared as far as Michigan to make an impact.
So ultimately in 2 years it would be great if we had snap gardens in all five cities up the corridor, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Rogers, Springdale, and Siloam Springs. So that's our aim, and our intention is for a regional expansion to work with any community that's interested in cultivating their own version of Feed Fayetteville. If the city of Springdale wanted to support and build capacity for the Growing Healthy Springdale Initiative, for example, then we would love to work with them and transfer our assets and the case studies and whatnot.
But for now, Terry and Schoenfeld say that the organization is focused on strengthening its current programs and operations and moving into its new home. Terry says that not only do they hope to have a completed master architecture plan in the coming year, but the group also hopes to soon publish its first issue of Edible Ozarkansas, a quasi-syndicated publication that features region-specific articles dealing with local food issues. But before that happens, they have to clean and finish converting the former church into the community center that they envision. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
The University of Arkansas Fort Smith's 32nd season of entertainment presents the University of Arkansas Fort Smith Jazz Band, Friday, a week from tonight at 7:30 at the Fort Smith Convention Center. The performance features student and world-renowned guest artists, including jazz vocalist Rosanna Eckhart and Jazz Cats. Tickets and information at uafs.edu.
Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
I mentioned earlier that we would be giving away a weekend pass for two to the Blues in the Natural State Festival that takes place April 5th and 6th. And here's the question that can get you entered into that contest. You can find the answer on the website ozarkbluessociety.org. It's on their front page. Question is, what year was the Ozark Blues Society founded? Okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry. If you know the answer, you can email us at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
Right, and we will announce a winner on Monday. Pass to everything for free.
Excellent. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Georgetown.
Ah, which is a G.
It is.
And that's where we were in the alphabet.
Uh-huh.
G also stands for grateful. We're very grateful that you've been listening and supporting us for 23 years now.
Yes.
As a news magazine on KUAF.
Very grateful.
Yes.
And also, G is for goodbye.
That's right, which we are about to say. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF 91.3 FM. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And before we say goodbye,
mm-hmm.
Sunday morning, weekend Ozarks at Large.
You.
Flying solo.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And we appreciate everyone who's listened in so far. Speaking of flying solo, you'll be on Monday's Daily Edition at noon with a brand new show.
I will, all by my lonesome.
Okay, I think you can handle it.
I think so.
All right, thanks so much for listening. Have a great Friday.
And enjoy the rest of your spring break.
Thanks.